Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know those pies? They've got a certain kind of nut in them. Lots of molasses, eggs, too. Some people put bourbon in them. That's really good. How do you pronounce the name of that nut? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 5th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Nut pronunciation lessons in just a minute. But you know what today is, right? Other than a Thursday that somehow feels like a Monday? It's Federal Reserve Minutes Day. Notes from the Federal Open Market Committee's most recent meeting a couple of 3 weeks ago. I sound excited, but to be honest, Fed minutes aren't always all that. Today, though, confirmation of what Chair Jay Powell alluded to in his press conference after that meeting, that the central bank is getting a tad worried about trade. Here's the quote. Most participants, the Fed said, noted that uncertainty and risks associated with trade policy had intensified and were concerned that such uncertainty and risks eventually could have negative effects on business sentiment and investment spending. So, eventually, as in not quite yet, but come midnight tonight, when another $34 billion in American tariffs on Chinese goods are set to kick in, things are going to start to get a whole lot more real. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going today with some of the ways that might show up in the economy.
One effect of a trade war, higher inflation as tariffs push up the price of imported goods and sellers pass on the extra costs to consumers. Lilac Nachum teaches international business at City University in New York.
We will trade less with the world and produce more ourselves. That's what Donald Trump wants. And as a result of that, companies are likely to raise prices.
But if a trade war really drags on and affects broad swaths of the economy, some economists say we could get the opposite effect. Deflation, mainly because a trade war could be a drag on growth, says Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The economy slows down. Workers are out of work. Every firm tries to cut its price to keep its market share, and voila, deflation.
Unlike inflation, which is easier to see as stuff gets more expensive, deflation and deflationary pressures kind of creep in behind the scenes, says Kyle Pomerleau, an economist at the Tax Foundation. For example, if a long trade war forces up prices of imported goods,
maybe domestic producers will enter the market, bringing the price down a little bit. But I think on net, you'd still see higher prices in those markets due to the tariffs.
And tariffs would have to drive prices higher for a while before new companies might want to enter the market. That can be hard to predict when you're not sure how long a trade fight or war will drag on. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
So about that, the whole how long it's going to last thing. At the bottom of the tariff policy food chain, way down from the people making the decisions, are the people who have to live with and make a living with those decisions. That said, there is a thing we got to do to set up this next story. Sounds kind of basic, but details matter. Here you go.
So I'm going to ask a really stupid question. These are all pecan trees?
These are all pecan trees. That's right.
All right. So first things first. You said pecan. I say pecan.
Pecan.
All right. So pecans.
Pecans.
That's a couple of weeks ago at the tail end of a reporting trip we did down to Columbus, Georgia, looking at manufacturing in this economy, how it's changing, and what the new realities of trade and tariffs are doing. The thing is, it's not just manufacturing that the tariffs are affecting, which got us driving across central Georgia to Hawkinsville and the Lamar Pecan Company, R.G. Lamar, following his dad and his grandfather, proprietor.
How many trees are here? How big is this?
This is about an 80-acre orchard, and there are 12 trees per acre. So what is
just
that?
Just because? Is that the rule with pecan trees?
For trees this size and this age, yeah, they have to be planted pretty far apart.
I mean, these are great trees. So these things hanging down, are those the flowers? Is that what happens?
Exactly. So right here, these are called catkins. That's the male flower.
Long, stringy-looking things.
Yep. And then if you'll look at this little, it's not like an almond flower. You can see it from anywhere, but that little bitty guy right there, those are the little pecan flowers. As you can see, there's four or five of them there.
Right.
Yep.
Georgia pecans are incredibly popular overseas, China in particular, which is complicating R.G. Lamar's life. Because on one of those lists of retaliatory tariffs that Beijing has put out was an extra 15% on American nuts. There are trees in this orchard we're standing in that are 110 years old, RG says. Younger ones as well, of course. It's all very green. The place is ginormous, and these trees are just waiting for harvest in October.
How do you harvest these things?
Great
question. You can't just wait for them to fall to the ground, right?
No, exactly, yeah. So we've got a big machine, very creatively called a tree shaker. these trees are, I guess you can't see them on the radio, these trees are over 100 feet tall.
Yeah, they're huge. I mean, these are serious trees.
So we shake the trees. The big trees like this, we have to shake each individual limb, actually. The smaller trees, we can do the whole tree. But we shake it to the ground, and then we have equipment that blows and sweeps them into rows, yeah. And then equipment that picks up the row.
And then what do you do with them? I mean, once you get them, do you shell them? Do you crush them? I mean, then what?
So it depends on where they're headed. Obviously, in this country, we don't have much of an appetite for in-shell pecans the way they do, say, for ballpark peanuts that you shell by hand. Don't have that here. In China, that's really popular, actually. So if they're going to China, we just put them in 50-pound bags and ship them overseas to Chinese customers. If they're staying here in the U.S., then we send them to processing plants in Georgia and Texas mainly, and they take the shell off.
How much of your market goes to China?
For us, it's about 60%. The U.S. market is about a third.
60%? That's a lot.
Yeah.
So I imagine you're following the international trade news pretty closely.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Well, tell me more, because that was an interesting little smile you got on your face. Definitely.
Obviously, with the potential trade war between the U.S. and China, and currently existing, the extra 15% tariff that China has put on pecans. When we started 10 years ago shipping to China, the tariff was 24%.
You started 10 years ago shipping to China and it's already 60% of your business?
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, in 2001, China imported less than 100,000 pounds of pecans from the U.S.
Wow.
And by 2012, it was 100 million pounds.
So when you started 10 years ago, it was 24%, worked its way down, the tariff did, to what before the latest round?
So in 15, it went to 10%.
Yeah.
Last year, it went to 7%.
And then you wake up one morning, and all of a sudden, 60% of your product is 15% more expensive.
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
What'd you do? You're a guy running a small business.
Well, my first knee-jerk was, okay, this isn't as big of a deal because 10 years ago, it was 24%. Now we've gone from 7 to 22.
Yeah.
So we're back to still less than where we started. But the difference is when we started, there was sort of a backdoor into China through Vietnam. Pecans aren't the only commodity that takes that route.
Yeah.
Pretty much all nuts go through that route.
It's kind of a gray market, right?
Kind of a gray market, exactly. Yeah. And so that's why the 24% didn't make a big difference then.
Here's the deal with that backdoor thing, the gray market, a loophole, really, that let a lot of American nuts, like RG said, go through Vietnam first and then on to China, virtually tariff-free. The Chinese were okay with it because consumers there could get American products, pecans in this case, at a good price. But that backdoor slammed shut when Chinese President Xi Jinping ramped up his anti-corruption campaign. So now, for RG and his nut-producing colleagues, there is no getting out of that 22% tariff.
If it goes on for a while, and it's 22% for reals, what's that going to mean for you? You're going to diversify away from the Chinese market? I mean, you can't, right? How do you do that?
Well, we realized all along for the last 10 years that having 60% of our crop going to one customer isn't the safest, most diverse way to sell our product. So we've been trying to diversify, and personally, what we've done is to create a consumer packaged brand, Front Porch Pecans. We really did it as a hedge in case something like this were to happen, you know, which would affect in-shell prices, especially Georgia. You know, I told you Georgia, where we send 60%, Georgia sends about half, the U.S. sends about a third. So the reason Georgia sends so much more is because we have larger pecans, which the Chinese prefer because they're eating them out of the shell.
Huh.
So we're also more vulnerable then to any kind of political issues with China.
So now what do? You just have to sit tight and wait and see what happens.
Exactly. That's all we can do. I was listening to a soybean farmer on the radio the other day, and he said, worrying about this is like worrying about the weather. And that's exactly what it feels like. We just, there's not a lot we can do about this.
But the thing is, unlike a soybean farmer who can choose each year what to plant, these trees are 110 years old, and it's not like you've got a choice. These nuts are coming, whether you can sell them to China or not.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And we love doing this. You know, I moved back here from a job in D.C. because I like the farm and I like what I do and the type of lifestyle it affords us. So I'm not going to do anything else if I don't have to, but it is worrisome, yeah.
So what happens if this doesn't get fixed? What happens if it's 22% from now till the end of time?
One thing, as always happens with trade issues, the furniture is just going to get rearranged, I think. China is going to consume the pecans. The only other country that has the volume that they need is Mexico. Mexico sends most of their pecans to the U.S. right now, so they wouldn't be coming here. So I think we would end up just selling more product domestically. There'd be demand there for that. We hope that Front Porch pecans will grow enough that we can rely on that somewhat too.
R.G. Lamar of Lamar Pecan, standing in the middle of his orchard in central Georgia, Hawkinsville, actually a couple of 3 weeks ago. If you want to get an idea of the bigger picture, we've crunched some of the data on pecan exports. It's up on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM there. And we've got those manufacturing stories we did from Columbus on that same trip online, marketplace.org. Three slices of making things in America in this global economy. On Wall Street today, pretty good for a Thursday that's really a Monday. Come on, you're feeling it too, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Part of a functioning labor market is that if companies don't want to hire you, all other things being equal, they don't have to hire you. And likewise, somebody doesn't like their job, they are generally free to look someplace else. That is not, though, always the case. Sometimes employees aren't at all free to look someplace else. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more now on what are called non-compete, sometimes non-poaching agreements as well.
Tony works in health and fitness. He's basically a fitness instructor.
In all of the health centers I've worked at, they've always had a sign, a non-compete, saying that after our last date of employment there would be up to a year of not working for any direct competitor.
We're not using Tony's real name. He doesn't want to get in trouble with his current or future employers.
There's no option. There's no negotiation. It's if you want a job, that's the agreement. I mean, it's very limiting and a little daunting to think that your options are so controlled by outside forces.
About a fifth of the U.S. workforce is covered by non-compete agreements like this. The idea behind non-competes is usually that a company doesn't want to share its trade secrets with an employee, only to have that employee take them to a competitor or become a competitor. Evan Starr is an assistant professor at the University of Maryland's Smith School of Business.
They are found where you would expect them to be found, in kind of high-skill, high-wage occupations like executives, high-tech.
But Starr says they're also found in places you would not expect them, like with fitness instructors.
They're being used on minimum-wage workers. They're being used by volunteers. A recent study of hair salons finds that approximately a third of hairstylists are bound by non-compete agreements.
Starr says the idea in some cases, like with a hair salon, is that an employer doesn't want an employee to steal customers they've built relationships with.
Any space where you have kind of the potential for employees to take clients with them, non-competes are probably going to be found.
Another spin on the non-compete agreement is the no-poaching agreement. It's where two businesses agree not to hire one another's workers. David Seligman is an attorney with worker advocacy group Towards Justice. He's suing Carl's Jr.'s restaurants over this, arguing franchises are colluding to hold down wages.
With these kinds of agreements, the employee often isn't even aware of their existence. What these kinds of agreements are, they're a tool to undermine worker bargaining power.
Carl's Jr. didn't respond to a request for comment. About 50% of major franchises have anti-poaching agreements.
The intent of our members has never been to suppress wages or the movement of employees.
Suzanne Beal is with the International Franchise Association. She says these agreements protect unique training that managers at fast food restaurants receive.
For another franchisee to poach that employee after the training, the expensive training has been concluded is has caused a friction between the franchisees.
That raises questions, though, about what constitutes special training and what is simply job experience that's a central aspect of the simple act of working. Whether non-compete and non-poaching agreements are legal depends on the details and on the state. They are, however, pervasive. They've been imposed on dog walkers and Little League soccer coaches.
I think in the aggregate, there's good reason to think that non-poaching agreements and non-competes are suppressing wages.
Eric Posner is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He says the agreements, especially among low-wage workers, tilt the scales towards employers when it comes to wages. Evan Starr at the University of Maryland says there's some evidence for this. In 2015, Hawaii banned non-compete agreements for tech workers. After that,
the wages of new hires rose by about 4% and mobility of workers increased in tech relative to other industries.
The boundaries of non-poaching agreements are being tested in several court cases, and limits on non-compete agreements are being considered in the U.S. Senate and Massachusetts. Illinois bans them for low-wage workers. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was always called the world's friendliest border, and it was that way so that the U.S. and Canada could do business together.
Geopolitics and geoeconomics. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 0.7% on this Thursday. 181 points closed at 24,356. NASDAQ up 1.1%, 83.7586. S&P 500 rose 0.8%, 23 points, 2736. Their late news of scandal-ridden EPA Chief Scott Pruitt's resignation didn't really do much to chemical and energy companies. It broke about 10 minutes before the bell. Dow DuPont rose 1.4%, ExxonMobil flat, Peabody Energy closed unchanged. Reportage that the Trump administration may be willing to eliminate tariffs on EU auto imports in exchange for more investment in U.S. manufacturing got you this. Volkswagen accelerated 4%. Daimler jumped 3.7%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is, as I think they say in the Hollywood trade papers, a boffo year for the American box office. Black Panther got things started over the winter. Now this summer is hot with The Avengers, Incredibles 2, Jurassic World, and Ocean's 8 as well. Millions of people have gotten up off their couches and into the multiplex. Ticket sales are headed towards $6 billion. So from WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris set out to discover why people are going back to the movies.
That's what I asked Patrick Corcoran with the National Association of Theater Owners. He says,
the movies is the short answer.
Longer answer, better movies, better experiences. And theaters are catering to showgoers, reclining seats, wine and cheese plates.
It used to be, you know, you'd go to dinner and a movie and the dinner was someplace else. And now you can get that at the movie theater.
And that keeps us coming back for more, adding up to the best theater revenues in years, especially compared to last year's ticket sales, slumping the lowest they'd been in a decade. What else influences moviegoers to keep coming back? Representation. So says Zach Shake with Magid, an entertainment research firm.
People like to see themselves represented on screen, whether it's exactly like themselves, you know, visually, or whether it's people who have similar problems.
Film historian Noah Eisenberg says the idea we go to the movies to escape reality, maybe not so much. It's more that we actually like to see interpretations of how society is grappling with the issues of the day, like franchisee fantasy-based blockbusters, Black Panther or Ocean's 8.
Whether it's Me Too or other, you know, kind of raging debates in Hollywood concerning the representation of women.
So is a ticket sales resurgence sustainable? With many media mergers on the horizon, Patrick Corcoran says there are doubts.
With fewer distributors in the marketplace, that there might be fewer movies.
Right now, people may be lining up to go to the movies for a more basic reason. So far, this summer's hot, and theaters are air-conditioned. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
One of, if not the, hallmarks of the Trump presidency to date has been his focus on borders. The southern border, of course, the travel ban as well, and now a trade war that's upending the way global commerce moves across our borders. Just this week, Canada, our closest ally, geographically certainly and geopolitically probably, hit back with its own steel and aluminum and assorted other stuff, tariffs, which is one of the reasons I'm talking to Porter Fox. He spent 3 years exploring the 4,000 miles of the U.S.-Canadian border from Maine out to Washington State for his new book, which is called Northland. Porter, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Give me a sense of what it's like when you're actually out there. I mean, did you know where the border was most of the time? Or were you hiking and canoeing and just kind of going on your merry way west? And did American authorities know where you were, since we're, you know, in theory, keeping closer eye on our borders?
Well, that's the big question. I crossed the border dozens of times on many different occasions, mostly because I was completely lost. It is wild, wild country. You're talking about some of the largest roadless areas in the United States, the boundary waters of Minnesota, the North Woods of Maine. I mean, these are places where you can just walk for hundreds of miles and not run into anything. So it was very hard to know where I was, and especially in these backcountry areas, there's just hardly any indication of what is Canada and what is the United States.
And that's the thing that comes through in this book, and part of that is just the way the population density works out. I mean, for us, the northern border is, and apologies to everybody who lives near there, and I've been up there and I like it, and it's lovely country, but it's remote and almost empty. But something like 90% of Canadians live within like 100 miles of the American border or something?
Yeah, they think it's very kind of hilarious that Americans don't go close to their northern border and don't really pay much attention to it. But 90% of them are within 100 miles of their southern boundary. And it's very unpopulated. About 10% of the U.S. lives along the U.S. northern border, and much of that is in border cities like Detroit and Bellingham. Yeah. And you know, you get into North Dakota and Montana, and it's just wild country.
Resource rich, though. Money poor, but resource rich, right?
Absolutely. And that's how a lot of it was settled as well. The timber trade, the fur trade. In modern times, you're looking at the Bakken oil play, the shale play. And so that's why a lot of those communities in the Northland are where they are.
Talk to me for a second about the cross-border economic dynamic, right? We hear about it on the southern border all the time, the maquiladoras and NAFTA and imports and exports. The Canadian trade relationship with the United States and the amount of trade going and coming across that border is monumental.
It's the busiest international border in the world. You're talking about $2 billion, nearly $2 billion in goods and services, 400,000 people legally crossing the line every day.
Every day?
Every day. And,
wow.
And you're looking at, giant U.S. like the auto industry. You know, an American-made car can cross the border up to 7 times. There's a border town in northern Maine where Canadians are cutting wood on one side of the line and bringing it over the line to mill it and then trucking it back over again. Hmm. You know, there are folks that drive those trucks, that run those chainsaws. You know, the border has been very permeable since the very beginning. Cross-border trade was, it was there before the border was there. Hmm.
When you got to the end out on the Pacific coast, what was your takeaway from this whole trip?
Well, I really saw the northern tier of the U.S. as a kind of standalone region. You know, that was what I was kind of hoping I would find. Another thing that I realized was, that this border was not taken seriously. The border was incredibly porous, and that, you know, some people would take that as being very alarming, but in reality, that was kind of how it was made. It was always called the world's friendliest border, and it was that way so that the U.S. and Canada could do business together. It's hard to talk about border security and say, well, sure, you can walk across the line wherever you want. But the answer is not to just lock it down. You know, the line is not hard, and it probably shouldn't be for the sake of both of our economies.
It's a book called Northland by Porter Fox. Porter, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Guy.
This final note on the way out today, we started with regular people and tariffs. We are ending with regular people and tariffs. I saw a tweet today from the Acme Pie Company. First of all, that's a real company, not some Wile E. Coyote thing. It's run by Saul Schott out of Arlington, Virginia, and he was tweeting about, yes, tariffs. So we called him up.
I have a little tiny pie company. I sell about 30,000 pies a year. Each pie pan increased about 13, 14 cents. So I just did the math, and I'm hoping I did it correctly because I'm probably getting quoted. And it came out to right about $4,000. And I was like, gee, that's going to come right out of my pocket.
He was getting quoted, and his math was right. All right, we got to go. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.